Welcome to the sound of one man clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker. The cicadas are still in charge, and I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. This is a podcast about board gaming culture, and growing old gracelessly, something I seem to be doing at rapid speed. Given the holiday season, the format today will be a little bit different. I'll talk through my Christmas gaming in the games that were. We'll touch lightly on FOMO Mofo in light of recent Boxing Day sales. And in Voices in My Head, I'm going to deep dive on a new campaign game that I've started. And hoo boy, spoiler alert, whoa. Also, this is a big week. We're recording three episodes. So we've got this one, we've got a bonus episode with Super Trooper, and we have our first very special international guest recording this week on Thursday. Watch this space, keep your earbuds charged. It's going to be a stellar week to 10 days with one man clapping, and on with the show. Well, it's just finished Christmas. We've just had a week of Christmas. I, for one, was at four different Christmas events, three of them at my house. So I have been cooking. I think we're on the verge of maybe starting a new segment, not so much here, but on our Facebook page, where I'm going to start sharing all my recipes for board gaming recipes, because we do some pretty fun stuff in the House of OMC for board gaming. Tomorrow we are having lamb koftas with flatbread, and I make the flatbread, and it is freaking simple as, and it's always a winner. So I'm thinking maybe Facebook, we're going to be laying down some of the OMC board gaming recipes for board gaming day snacks. But today, oh man, I'm done with cooking. We had porchetta, we had triple smoked ham with root beer glaze. Yes, root beer glaze. If you're in the North Americas, guys, one can A&W of root beer, 1.5 cups of brown sugar, simmer till thick. Brush your ham with that 6 times in the last hour and a half every 50 minutes, and you will thank me for the rest of time. I stumbled on that recipe one day, being a good Canadian boy. I love A&W root beer, about 8 years ago, and I have never, ever done a ham differently. It goes on the smoker, 4.5 hours, root beer glaze. It will change your life. Now, as for the games that were, the Pina and I finished the exit calendar for this year, so I'm going to go into just a couple of very small spoilers. So if you haven't finished yours, skip ahead, I don't know, 3 minutes, 3.5, 4 minutes, maybe 4 minutes. The exit calendar this year, aside from 1 or 2 days where the puzzles were really tedious and boring, and there weren't many. I think there were maybe 2 days where we just went, no, thank you. There were some super clever puzzles this year, including, last chance, spoiler alert, one of the days, the door didn't even open. There was no door, and if you've done the exit calendar, advent calendars, you know, there's 24 doors on the front. You've got to crack the code to work out which door is next, because there's no numbers on the doors. So we got to this box, and there was no door. It was clearly where we were supposed to go, but there was no door. There was a tiny slit, and there was a little hole with a you know, an image of a flashing red light. And the solution was so much fun. In another box, in another room, we found a little reflective card, like a mirror back card. And we had to slide that in through the slot. And then we had to peer through this teeny tiny hole with a torch. And the solution was actually on the ceiling of the box. And it was reflected in reverse. And the peanut cracked it in like point. She's like, Dad, this goes in here. We look in here. Give me the torch. It's so much fun. And she just gets these light bulb moments. She just goes, oh, shazam, and gets these light bulb moments and cracks into these. And it is a blast. And it was one of those puzzles that you just laugh out loud when the solution comes to it. And you're peeking in this tiny hole like a mouse gynecologist. Honestly, it is like it was about 6 mils across. And you can see the solution. It was wild. There was another one where we had to shine a torch. You know, the code, you get these little poems that describe what you've got to do. But what you really had to do is you had to put the torch in the room next door. And the code kind of illuminated on the wall. And you had to turn all the lights off and sit in the dark. It was awesome. It was so awesome. And then the final solution was on the back of the box. You had to carve open the back of the box to find this hidden room. Because the 24th room on the front was actually a janitor's closet. And when you went to open it when you were all done, you got chastised for not having the self-restraint to not open the last box. You know, there's a little mop and bucket in there. The exit calendar is always a blast. We love it. It's here on in. It is our Christmas tradition, the Peanut and I. And it was amazing. For the $50, you get 24 moments, and that might be 24 moments at 5 minutes, or it could be 3 minutes, it could be 12 minutes. Some of them are a bit brain-burning, but it's great. Next year, you can do them out of cycle. You can get all the old ones as well. They come out, you can buy them all through the year, and if you just want to do something fun, you know, with your kids or with your wife, a little bit after work, 5 minutes after work, I can't recommend them enough. The exit advent calendars are an absolute blast, and the solutions are always wild. One of the days, we actually had, you got these huge elastic bands and a little bridge out of the box, and you had to turn the entire advent calendar into a guitar and play a tune on this little graphic that you didn't know was guitar notes until you got there. And oh, so good. Chef's kiss. Love the exit calendar. And another one that we got to the table, I bought this a little while ago, and it's been sitting on the shelf still in shrink, and it's a little small box game. It's borderline, I wouldn't even call it a filler, because it's about 40 minutes start to finish, and that is Bonanza. Now, okay, not Bonanza, because Bonanza has these ridiculous anthropomorphic beans. The art, it's fun and whimsical, but it is crazy. And Bonanza is a classic. I'd never played Bonanza, but it gets highly rated. There's a lot of people that go Bonanza. It's, you know, it's I think it's Nuve Rosenberg, way, way back, like 1980s way back. And the original art is ridiculous. But last year they released Bonanza Dahlias. And the art's by Beth Sobel. And you know Beth Sobel. You might not realize it, but Beth Sobel is the artist who does Wingspan. She's done Calico, Cascadia, a few others. She really specializes in those sort of nature-esque kind of artwork and graphics. And it's beautiful. Arboretum. That's another one of Beth Sobel. She did Arboretum. So she does big whiz-bang stuff like Viticulture and little boutique-y stuff that's single cards like Arboretum. Anyway, dahlias, you've got, I think it's 8 different kinds of dahlias. And they're immaculately illustrated on the cards. And the way Bonanza plays, if you haven't played Bonanza, because I'd not actually played Bonanza until we played Bonanza Dahlias, and we have since played, I think, 7 games of it. You've got basically 2 flower beds in front of you, and on your turn, you've got a hand of 5 cards. You start with 5 cards. You cannot change the order. You have to play the top card. You have to play it into your flower beds. So first round, that's a piece of cake. You've got 2 empty flower beds. You play the card, and then you have a choice to play the second card, and it has to be the second card in order in your hand. And this is where the tactics come into play later in the game, because this goes a little bit sidereal confluence later in the game. I think, you know, Super Trooper would love this. So you can play the second card, but bearing in mind that every time your turn comes around, you have to play the top card in your hand. And if you can't play the top card, you have to rip up one of your flower beds. So you play the top card as a mandatory, you play it into your flower beds, and then you have to turn 2 off the deck. There's a deck in the middle. It's a big, chonky deck. It's like a good 5 centimeters tall. It's a chonky deck. There's a lot of cards you start with. And you flip the top 2. And then the negotiation begins. So you can plant those. If you get lucky and you flip the top 2 and they match cards in your flower bed, you're like, huzzah! And you drop them in and you're going. And you want to do that because this is a set collection game. And the more flowers you can collect in your set before you have to rip them up, the more points you're going to get. So, for example, you might be collecting Moonchilds, I think they're called. And if you can get 5 Moonchilds, you get 2 coins. But if you can get 7 Moonchilds in your bed, you get 3 coins. If you have to rip it up with only 3, you get 0 coins. Okay? And this gets prickly pretty fast. Because if you happen to have 2 stacks in your flower bed, so you've got 2, and let's say 1 has 3 cards in it, 1 has 2 cards in it, you're on your way to building a set that gets you coins. If on your flip portion of your turn, you flip 2 flowers you don't have, you want to get rid of them. So then you start going around the table and you start trying to negotiate for someone else to take these flowers. Now, in a perfect world, they take those flowers and they give you something that you have in your flower bed. So if I've got, I can't even remember them now. If I've got brothers, they're called brothers, and I've got Indian lace or whatever they are. and I flip over two that I don't have, right? I really want to get rid of those. I don't want to have to rip up my two flower beds if I've got a nice stack of flowers forming. So I'll say to the fox, would you like one of these? And she'll go, no, I really don't. And I look over and she's only got, say, one flower in each bed. It doesn't hurt her any to take them, but it may be that she has other cards in her hand that match her flower bed. So I go around and go, Peanut, will you take one of these cards that I've turned over? And she'll go, no. Well, then you can sweeten the deal with stuff in your hand. And this is where your hand management is super clever because, as I've said, you can only play the top card in your hand. You have to play the cards in the order in which you draw them. So if the top card in my hand is not something that I have in my flower bed, on my next turn, I'm going to have to rip up one of my flower beds to play that card. But if I look at my hand and I say the top card is something the Peanut's collecting, I go, well, if you take this Indian lace, I'll give you a second Indian lace, which is in my hand. Which means if she's going to rip something up in her hand, in her flower bed, I'm sweetening the deal by giving her two to start with. Because once trades are over, you have to plant what you've traded. They can't go into your hand for later. They have to go into your flower bed. And this is a really clever bit of game mechanic. I can understand why Bonanza is so popular. Bonanza Dahlia is a great game. And it's pretty. The original Bonanza is ridiculous. It's like something that Benny Hill dreamt up when he was on heroin. Not that Benny Hill did heroin. I'm not suggesting Benny Hill was a heroin addict. I'm just talking about Benny Hill was crazy as fuck. And so then, once you've done your trades, you plant them, and then you have to draw three more cards. And those three cards go into the back of your hand in order that you draw them. So you are then in a situation where you want to get your two flower beds as full as possible before you have to rip them up and harvest them. Because on your next turn, you have to play a card from your hand. And if it doesn't match your flower bed, you have to rip up one of your flower beds. Oh, the push-pull on it is so juicy and so lovely. And the Peanut, just intuitively, like, she's an ace. I think she's won two of the last four games we've played. She absolutely gets this very, very quickly. And that trading mechanic of, well, I want that card that Dad's got. I'm going to sweeten it with two more from my hand, which also free up the glut from your hand so you can get at the cards you want sooner. It's delicious. Bonanza Dahlias is not just a great game. You know, whoever Rosenberg makes great games. It is gorgeous to look at. Plays in about 35 to 40 minutes. And it's wonderful. There's also a tiny little mechanic of counting cards. Because if I rip up a flower bed of five moon childs, whatever they're called, and that gives me two coins, I keep two of those cards face down to represent the coins. So as you're ripping up and harvesting for points, the amount of flowers that go back into the draw deck once the discard's full is diminished each round. So you basically play through the draw deck three times, but the draw deck basically shrinks by half every time it's drawn. So the last two rounds go pretty much in the same time as the first round. Bonanza, I'd never played. As I said, it gets talked up a lot on over the years by a lot of different people as being a classic that everyone should play. I get why, because the gameplay is a delight. That little bit of negotiation. Super Trooper, I know you're going to be listening to this. That's going to prepare the next generation, you know, Beelzebubbles and the Peanut for Sidereal Confluence, because that back and forth of, well, you take this card and I'll take that one, or I'll give you these three cards for that one, because you're also, as I said, you've got to play your cards in order, and you'll have a lot of crap in your hand that you don't want to play. So if you can sweeten the deal, you can also just straight up give cards away. You can, when it's your turn to trade, you can just start giving stuff away out of your hand to other players to free up the queue in your hand. It's a delight. It's gorgeous to look at. It's a blast to play. And as I said, I bought this. It's hard to get in Australia. I believe I bought it on Amazon International because it's one I've been looking for a while. I don't think it's formally released in Australia. But I'm pretty sure if you go onto Amazon, you can get it, you know, internationally through Amazon. If you're a Prime member, it's free shipping. And if you're overseas, if you're listening in the States, you could probably get it everywhere for $3. I'm being facetious because games are much cheaper overseas and easier to get. But a delight to play. And to be honest, I'm actually going to stop there because I've only played three games in the last week. And the third game I've played nine times. And I'm going to save that for Voices in My Head. It's going to be a big couple of weeks. I've got the boys and girls around for New Year's Eve tomorrow. I've got two more weeks off work. Betrayal of the Second Era still hasn't arrived. That's okay. I'm not going to drop dead of a stroke, thankfully. But I do have a lot of time up and coming, and I will be playing a lot of games. So watch this space. As I said, lots of content coming this week and lots of games for next week's episode. That is the games that were those two. Now, granted, I think we played 19 sessions of Exit, but it is what it is. For FOMO Mofo, I don't have... There's no crowdfunding going on. There's no pledge managers opened. There's no new crowdfunding that is basically dropped. There's a couple of cool announcements, and I'll talk about one of them. But, you know, we just went through Boxing Day sales, and I've got to be honest, the Boxing Day sales in Australia this year were really lukewarm. They were really meh. And look, I kind of get it in a lot of ways. The economy's... It's a tough time right now. Everyone's contracting. Mortgage rates have gone up 19 times, whatever it is. It's a huge number, right? Like, it's huge. Mortgage stress in Australia is a very real thing. And so, you know, a lot of friendly local game stores, these are owned by people who are families. You know, shout out to my favorites, More Than Meeples in Brisbane, Gameology in Melbourne, Advent Games in the Central Coast, north of Sydney, Games Empire over in Castle Hill. They're some of my favorites in Sydney. Behold Games, which is in Inner West in Sydney, all owned by legends who work very hard to bring games to us. And you know, yes, I get games from Uncle Jeff Bezos because they're cheap often, but I do try to spend money. And the two I spend the most with are More Than Meeples and Gameology, closely followed by Advent and then Games Empire. Support your local game store if you can, guys. But look, and I think everyone's been doing a little bit tough this year. So realistically, the best was going around was everyone sort of said, well, Boxing Day is 10% off. And I hope that worked for them. I really do, because the death of the friendly local game store is going to be a horrible thing for our beautiful hobby. And I hope it never happens. And I know that every time I spend money at Amazon, it hurts them a little tiny bit. And it's just the unfortunate bit that if I can save $20 on a game, and sometimes it's more than $20, then that's what I'll do. But the places I buy from are often places that are carrying a lot of bespoke stuff. Like the names I've mentioned, you know, they're carrying stuff that Amazon doesn't carry, which is absolutely wonderful, and high five to the whole lot of them. But Boxing Day, you know, Amazon didn't have a lot. They had a lot of mainstream stuff on sale. You know, we obviously had the chat going around in our board game Facebook group, stumbling through that. God, what is wrong? We had a lot, you know, 2 days of chat going through the Facebook group, our local game group. Not a ton going on. There are a few deals up and about. And as I said, you know, the local game stores didn't have a lot to offer, which is fine. Because realistically, retail, I'm not a retail buyer. You know, most people I'm friends with and play games with, we're not typically retail buyers. We're crowdfunding and boutique buyers when the stuff comes out. I did have one great find. And I say great find with the caveat that I think it's probably a great find because this particular game didn't review very well. And I'm talking about Lords of Ragnarok, which was an Awakened Realms crowdfunding release this year. If you look at the campaign, I think you can still late buy stuff. I know that's going around a lot. And I know that some of the local game stores are still selling that game, including the stretch goals, for $300 Australian, right? Which is a lot. Not a lot for that caliber of game, let's be honest. You know, if you get the core box and the stretch goals for $300, that's a lot. Awakened Realms stretch goals box are packed full of stuff. But there must have been a flood of releases. There must have been a container that dropped in Australia of Lords of Ragnarok, because I picked up Lords of Ragnarok, the core game, for $59. Now, I've got that from Gameology, so I'm hoping it's still the Kickstarter version, but we'll see. But the good news is I managed to find the stretch goals box at another retailer who I think had run out of core games, so they were just flogging off the stretch goals box. So I got the stretch goals box for another $56, $57. So I got Lords of Ragnarok, hopefully the full Kickstarter edition, for about $120, which, as far as I can tell, is still being sold at some retailers for $300. So for me, that was my Boxing Day win. I know it didn't get reviewed glowingly. There are a lot of people that said it, because I think this was the spiritual successor to Lords of Halas. I think I've got that right. Send me an email or a message if I've got that wrong. But I think this was the spiritual successor to Lords of Halas. And there are a lot of improvements, a lot of quality of life improvements, a lot of gameplay improvements. it's a beautiful looking game on the table. There's got a lot going on. There's minis everywhere. It's area control. It's Ragnarok, right? You know, everyone loves a bit of that. And as I said, for $59 for the base game, if we get three plays out of it in the next couple of years, I'm happy to play it and pass it on to somebody else. So that was my FOMO mofo, which was not really FOMO mofo. It was like a, hey, this is a good deal. So we'll call that impulse mofo. Because I almost backed Lords of Ragnarok. It's one of those I almost backed. Like Stalker, like the latest Nemesis campaign. I think it was Nemesis Retaliation. I was almost all in for Nemesis Retaliation because I love the look of Nemesis. I love the way it's alien. I'm Gen X. It's alien, right? Like, if I can't see my mom, I'll take a face hugger, right? Love is love. But I didn't. I didn't because I wasn't quite sold on the gameplay. Hashtag enormity is coming out next year. But Lords of Ragnarok is one that I looked at when it was in crowdfunding, and I've actually managed to get it cheaper than the original crowdfunding price. So impulse mofo it is, and I'm very happy with that. That'll do. This week on Voices in My Head, I'm going to do something I don't normally do, and I'm going to talk about one game. Now, when I talk about this game, I'm also going to talk about it as it sits in its category of games, because there's a lot of things this game does that's quite unique. And look, let's not bury the lead. This is a campaign game. Today I'm talking about Agamonia. Now, Agamonia, if you are watching the top 50 lists of the year, top 20, whatever it is, it's on a lot of top 10s, top 20s, top 25s, top 30s. It's on a lot. And I picked up Agamonia this year retail, and it was the Kickstarter version from the last campaign. Agamonia just had a relaunch, a reprinting Kickstarter with some new stuff and a new character, whatever the case is. And I was looking at Agamonia on Kickstarter. I'm like, oh, that looks really good. Oh, I should pick that up. And then I hopped over to, again, I'm going to shout out to Gameology in Melbourne. And Gameology in Melbourne had a copy from the original Agamonia campaign for a very reasonable price. And I don't think there are a lot of corrections in Agamonia in the campaign. There's not a lot of errata. There's a little bit, and the errata is really easy to deal with. I thought, you know what? I'll grab it now, and I don't have to wait. And so I got Agamonia, and I punched it, and it sat on my shelf at first for, I want to say, a good 2.5 months. Now, like any campaign game, I'm sure that most of you dear OMC clappers have played a campaign game or two, whether it's Pandemic or Clank or Jaws of the Lion, whatever it happens to be, there's a learning curve. And Agamonia's learning curve is so smooth. It is so smooth. Like, I'm not being funny. Agamonia's first three scenarios are all tutorials. And I really love that. When I was first playing deep into campaign games and Super said, oh, you should try Gloom, or we've got Gloomhaven, you should try Gloomhaven. I'm like, yeah. And he said, well, actually start with Jaws of the Lion because it's Gloomhaven light and it works you in. I got Jaws of the Lion, and the first five scenarios in Jaws of the Lion are all tutorials, and they introduce the game mechanics little by little. They drip feed you. And Agamonia does the same thing, does a little bit more compressed in those first three scenarios. And by the end of the first three scenarios, you know how to play the game. I'm not going to pretend I'm not still looking at the rule book, but the Agamonia tutorial scenarios are excellent. They really walk you through the mechanics. And so let's wind this back. So Agamonia is a campaign game, and it's a campaign game where the scenarios are built into spiral-bound books, much like Jaws of the Lion, which I love, because setup is you plunk the book out, you open it up, the setup is in the book. You play in the book, and then the resolution of that scenario, you flip to the back of the book, and there's like an index at the back with the resolutions for each scenario. Now, Agamonia, you look at it, and it is wild. Like, it is pastel blue, pastel pink, pastel green. Like, your minis are robin's egg blue. I'm trying to make some time to just run a bit of Nuln Oil over them or something to give them a bit of definition. There's nothing wrong with the minis. They're just a weird color. And then Agamonia itself is this vibrant, like, post, like, if you ever, did you play Fallout, what was the Fallout, Far Cry, what was the Far Cry, what was post-nuclear? It was so good, but it was just wild with colors. And you're walking through the landscape in Agamemnon, and there's pinks and blues and oranges. And by the time you get to the end of your third scenario, you're just in the world. I actually think that's part of their clever world building, because it's so wild that by the time you get to the end of your sort of third scenario, you're just accepting the fact that you're walking through a pastel green forest to get where you need to go. So the art is one thing. And the art, there's nothing wrong with the art, but the color scheme in Agamemnon, it's weird at first. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's really confronting to sit down, you open it up, and normally you open up, you know, Gloomhaven or Jaws of the Lion or Frosthaven or Oathsworn or ISS, and it's like steel and dark gray and charcoal and space and chainmail and, oh man, it's like, it's serious. Agamemnon doesn't look serious. And you open it up, and to be honest, when I first was looking at Agamemnon, it's hard to take it seriously. Because unless you've watched the gameplay or done anything with it, you look at it and go, well, what is this? Is this an accident? Is this designed by somebody who's never designed games before? But the world building in Agamemnon is some of the best I've experienced. I'm not going to bury the lead. This game is great. I think I've played Agamemnon 8 times in a week. I cracked it open, I want to say, the 23rd of December, and I've played 8 scenarios since. And a scenario is a good 3 hours. By the time you do the scenario, then the standard city step, which is not standard. We're going to come to that. It's about 3 hours a scenario, which means I've pumped about 24 hours into Agamemnon in 8 or 9 days, which is a big deal for me to basically drop 24 hours into one game. I mean, start of the year, I did similar for both ISIS, Vanguard, and Tainted Grail. But Agamemnon is, it's that kind of game. And there's a couple of mechanics in that I really like we're going to come to. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what Agamemnon is. So Agamemnon is an emergent narrative. And that might sound commonplace, but that emergence carries through into the scenarios themselves. And what I mean by that is you'll start a scenario, and each scenario has a deck of cards, a dedicated deck of cards. And it might be 12 cards, it might be 30 cards. And they all have letters and or numbers and or symbols on them, depending on how they play in. And you open the scenario up, and it might be, let's say it's a warehouse. And it's a warehouse. You open it up, it tells you what you're going to need. You might need a little hand-pulled wagon, you might need whatever the case is. And at most, it might say, hey, you notice there's traps laying around. And so you go and you throw 3 or 4 traps around. You don't know what kind of traps they are, you don't know what they do, you don't know what their power is, you don't know anything. And so you've got this warehouse, and you've got your characters. I'm playing four-handed. My 4 characters are all huddled in that little starting square, that little starting space. And you're off. And what's really interesting, and this is, I think, what drew me in with Agamemnon, is all over the map, you've got these letters. And a letter indicates a card in the scenario deck. So it might be letter A, it might be letter Q. It depends how far it goes. So let's say 3 spaces out from me, it says A1. Okay, what that means is that when I get within 1 range of A, I can pull the A card out and read the front of it. And it might say, so I move forward, I take a couple of steps with one of the characters, and it gets within 1 range, and you pull the A card, and it says, you notice 3 broken crates sitting under a dirty oiled cloth. There's a rancid smell coming out of them and some kind of weird energy. And then it will say a number of things. It could say, when you're at range 0, flip the card. It could say, when you're at range 0, you can do a might test to crack open the crate. It could say, when you get to range 0, you've got to do a wisdom test, a will test, because there's something in there that's psionic that's pressurizing. So you get a little hint as to what that might be when you get close to it. Could be range 1, could be range 2. A lot of them are range 0. You don't notice them until you're standing on top of them. And so then, let's say it says you've got a will, you've got to pass a will test of 5. And so then you look at your characters and go, well, who's got a lot of will? Who's got a chunky willpower? Well, my wizard's got chunky willpower. So the wizard's going to be the one that I actually take into that space to investigate that card. Because you can feel the psionic power coming off of it. And I know I'm going to need somebody who's got a little bit of wisdom to manage that test, that skill test. And so I march my wizard in there, and it will say, you've got to pass a will test of 5. So that means I've got to have 5 successes. Now, here's what I love in Agamonia is you've got dice. And I'm not a huge fan of dice, but more and more game designers and developers are using dice in ways that aren't painful. They're not hurtful. You're not rolling a die and you're just done, right? And what Agamonia does is in these tests, you've got to roll dice. There are no blank faces on these dice. Each of these die faces have some kind of success. So if it's a will test and it says will test 5, I have to have 5 successes. Now I'll look at my character, my wizard, and she's got a will of 3, which means I get to throw 3 dice. And I have to try to get 5 successes with 3 dice. Now 5 successes with 3 dice, it could be a piece of cake, it could be unattainable. Because the dice have 3 different faces on them. They have a single success. They have 4 different faces. They have a single success, they have a double success, they have a single success which allows you to then roll another die. And they have a stress test. So a single success is just that. It's 1. A double success is 2 successes. If you roll one that has a single plus 1, which you get to take 1 success and add another die to your pool. So, and then the stress one allows you to spend stamina, which is a currency for your characters. If you roll a stress test, you get to spend 2 stamina, which exerts yourself, which can push you over the line to that success of 5. It is super clever. There's another resource called achievement tokens. They're little gems that you can spend for an immediate plus 1 on any of your tests as well. And you only really get achievement tokens. There are other ways. I'm not going to go into those. But at the end of a scenario, based on the different achievements you have made, if it's a group achievement, every one of your characters gets an achievement token. If somebody individually has achieved something, they get a single one. And the more of these you have, the more you can mitigate. Now, you can only spend 1 per test. No matter what the test is, you can only spend 1 of these tokens. So you can't just drop 4 of them and turn an abysmal failure into a success. But between spending your stress and these achievement tokens, you can more often than not nudge a success out. Now, that success ends up coming at a cost because your stamina is obviously limited. If you've got 9 stamina, these are your, think of them as your action points, but they're also your health. And we're going to come to that because this is the other thing about Agamonia that's super clever. So anyway, you've got these dice checks and you've got these investigations. And what happens is your deck of cards over the course of doing a scenario becomes slowly exposed. And you'll get to see the top part of the card as you approach the different areas. And then when you enact or do whatever's on the top part of the card, you get to flip it and you get the bottom. Now, sometimes you expose a card and it will say, you have tripped and crazed a ruckus and 3 guards come running. Spawn guards in here, here, and here. And that's then, boom, you've got baddies on the map. I like Gloomhaven a lot. I like Frosthaven a lot. I like Jaws of the Lion a lot. But when you start a scenario, unless there's a locked door, you know exactly what you're up against. And that's fine too. What I love about Agamonia is you go into this room and the scenario itself is emergent. You have no idea what you're facing until you ease your way out into the room or into the cavern or into whatever it is. And then stuff starts coming in. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. Now, combat, and we're going to come to the initiative system later, but combat uses the same dice system in that baddies have either a might attack, they have a dexterity attack, or they have a will attack. And if they are attacking with might, and your character has a high might level, so let's say a baddie's attacking with 4 might, that means they're going to do 4 might damage. You have to have 4 might successes. So if your character has 2 might, they're rolling 2 might dice to then mitigate that attack. And so that level of successes is carried through into this really clever push and pull combat. Now, unfortunately, your combat defense dice, because during combat you're rolling a different die, they do have blank faces. However, that's where armor and helmets and shields and other sort of abilities come into play. It's really clever. So you've got this card-driven narrative, which what it means is your story, which typically in a lot of campaign games only happens outside of your encounters, your story carries on into the scenario. So in a scenario, if you've got 12 cards, each of those cards is going to contribute this little dribble to the story of what you're experiencing in the scenario. And it means that the scenario itself has so much flavor and adds so much value to the experience. And look, I'm not crapping on Gloomhaven, but in Gloomhaven, you get a bit of story and you go and you're in a cavern and you've got a whack-a-mole seven columns, one way or another, and you've got stuff shooting at you while you do it. Or you've got to wipe out everything on the board, or you've got to somehow get through and there's traps everywhere. And that's a wonderful tactical challenge with some mid-tier sort of strategy layered into it. And it's wonderful. I mean, Gloomhaven's, you know, in the top five, I think it's number four now? Number four in the Board Game Geek, Board Game Geek of all time? It's up there, and it's there for a reason, and deserves to be there. Agamonia, you have to unpick. Like, you don't even know how to win a scenario when you start. You'll set the scenario up, and the scenario setup will say, you'll be told when you've won. You'll be told if you won. And if the timer ends, you lose. And we're going to talk about the timer. Because most scenarios have a timer. And the timer is equally delicious. So the timer, it might say, in a three-player game, set a timer for 40. In a four-player game, set the timer for 25. Whatever the case is. And you have 10-sided dice, and you set them up. And there's a timer on the board. And you have a fate deck. Now, a fate deck is think of it like the Gloomhaven modifier deck. They're little mini American cards, mini Euro cards. I'm not sure what the exact size is. And there's about 25 of them. And they have numbers 1 through 5. And they have an arrow on them as well. And so what you do is at the end of each turn, you flip the fate deck. And whatever number that is, you decrement your timer by that. So if it's a 1, you knock 1 off. If it's a 5, you knock 5 off. So you also only have a vague notion of how long the scenario is. And this puts a delightful pressure on your decisions. Now, the fate deck only flips at the end of each round. So the round doesn't necessarily go any faster if you have four characters. And in fact, this is one of those games where I think multi-handing more characters is far better. You know, there's games like Isis Vanguard and Tate de Grail that scale the way the scenario works, the way you interplay with the scenario at 2 or 3 or 4. And the way Agamonia does that is it just alters the timer. So for example, if you've got 4 characters out, you've got much less time on the clock because you've got more moves before you have to flip a fate card. So you flip a fate card and it will decrement your timer, and the little arrow will tell you where to spawn baddies if you have a spawn card out. So if you've got something out for a creature that's been unveiled during the scenario, that little arrow will tell you which of the 4 spawn points to drop one in. And if you haven't got a creature, you just ignore it. You just move on. Oh, let's talk about initiative. So initiative in Agamonia, so interesting. So you've got your bad guys, you've got your baddies, and your baddies have 5 different components to them. They've got their 3 actions, which are slow, which is represented by a sleepy eye, moderately quick, which is represented by a half-lidded eye, and wide awake, which is alert and represented by an open eye. And then you have 2 more. One is represented by the image of a serpent, and one by the image of ram's horns. And so you're going to flip the initiative card over, and it's going to have 6 rows in it. Before you do that, you are going to do an action selection for your character, and your characters can do all kinds of stuff. And it's on their board. So there's no hand of cards like in Gloomhaven. Going into a scenario, you choose what you want to slot into your action board. And you've got 4 actions innately on the board. And by the time you get to level 2, you've got 3 more slots you can use. And these are specific actions. Think about the actions that are on Gloomhaven cards, but you're choosing which ones you're going to take going into the scenario. So you've got 1, 2, you've got 4 that are hard built onto every board that everyone has, and then you slot 3 more in at level 2, and by the time you are done, you have 8 slots, and you can see the slots, and I know this, I may not be making any sense, but anyway, you're choosing which actions you're programming going into the scenario, and at higher levels, some of these slots you don't have to choose until you need to. So slots 3 and 5, for example, you don't have to pre-select. You can leave them blank, and then when you want to slot something in, you can later in the scenario. You go, well, I need this ability. You go, chunk, it's in there. However, it's in there for the rest of the scenario. You can't take it out. And so you're going to choose which action you want to do At the start of each round, I'm going to choose X, Y, and Z. One of these, this is what I'm going to do. And some of the actions are to take a break and refill your stamina or heal some wounds. You can heal 2 damage. And then you flip the initiative card. And the initiative card will have 6 rows. 3 rows for the heroes, 3 rows for the bad guys. And they're color-coded. Because each of your actions are color-coded either red, green, or blue. And they actually go red, blue, or green. Red is the fast action. Blue is the middle action. Green is the slowest action. And you work through this initiative card top down. So if you're lucky, it's got your hero icons at the top. If you're unlucky, it's got all the bad guys at the top. And it might say you're activating the red bad guy because the 3 different bad guys you have, the 3 different baddies that you're fighting in this scenario are color-coded. They're going to be red, blue, or green. And then it will have an image of a half-lidded eye, a squinty eye, or an open eye. And you go and refer to the baddies card and you follow the iconography on the card. It is a piece of cake to run. And much like Gloomhaven, if you've got 4 of them on the board, you run through the standees in order 1-4. The initiative is so clever because some of the later abilities for your characters allow you to slot a, say, green action, which would be last in line, but then push yourself and drop and overlay it and make it a red action, which means you're going to be top of the order for characters. The initiative's a delight. And it means that, unlike in something like Gloomhaven, where you play your card and you go, well, I know I'm going to be 12 on out of 100, whatever the case is. And you're not meant to talk around the table, but you might go, well, I'm going moderately slowly this turn, guys, wink, wink. I'm going to be going quite sluggishly. You don't know what the initiative is for the bad guys in the encounter. Very similarly, and in this case, you flip the initiative, and it's there, and it's transparent, and you work through it. It's clever. It's so, so clever. I have not lost a scenario yet. I am playing on normal difficulty, and the way the difficulty is moderated is by the cards that you have in your initiative deck. So if you want a slightly harder game, you slot in a different set of cards into the initiative deck and they crank up the abilities for the bad guys. That emergent investigative scenario with the fate deck, which means you know kind of how long the scenario is going to be, but not really, because if all the 5s are at the top of the fate deck, you're going to whistle through your timer pretty quickly. Combined with the initiative system, I think makes Agamonia something quite unique. Now, yes, it's a campaign game. It's another campaign game. But if you're watching, you know, the top 10 or top 20 lists out there for 2024, I'm finding Agamonia is on most of these lists. Now, Tainted Grail also came out in 2024. And I love Tainted Grail, but I've noticed that Tainted Grail isn't on everyone's top of 2024. Agamonia is on everyone's 2024. Not everyone's. Agamonia is far more present on the 2024 list. So that's the scenarios. And the scenarios they're a delight to unfold. And they're full of surprises. I played a scenario, I won't tell you which, I'm not about spoilers, but I played a scenario yesterday where the timer ran out. And at the end of that, you flip the card over, you read the bit of flavor text from the scenario book because the timer ran out. And it says you got a choice. You pick up your shit and run, or you stand your ground, reset the timer, and keep going. And so I thought, for all intents and purposes, that the scenario was going to be done. And it gave you a choice. Well, you can keep going, and we reset the timer and go again. Or just make like a goose and flock off, you know. And it was great. For the record, I flocked off. Love it. Now, in between scenarios, you have a city phase. And the city phase is where you do all your typical city phase stuff. Now, you don't have a settlement or anything like you do in, say, Gloomhaven or Frosthaven or any of those sort of big whiz-bang ones. But in the city phase, that's where you're going and you're crafting. You're going to see the merchants and you're buying stuff. But you're also advancing your narratives in more meaningful ways. So you're traveling through the city and you're handing in your fetch quests, for example. Or each of your characters has this little booklet that has its own story in it. And every level, you read a few more pages and it unlocks a few more abilities. And at the back of each of those is kind of a choose-your-own-adventure for each character that's unique and likewise emergent. So, and at different points in the narrative, depending on what you do, it's going to say, well, go read passage 27 at the back of your character book because this has happened. And you go and you learn something more about your character. And sometimes it unlocks a new ability. Or you get to the end of that and you find a new ally. This game has pets. The pets are fantastic. They're not just roaming. I mean, the pets follow you around the board and they lay waste on bad guys in the most subtle way. I've got one that just harries. He just sits there. And if anyone moves out of the space that it is, it just takes damage. And pets can't be targeted. They're a delight. They just sit in the background panting delightfully. I've got this little weird lizard thing that I just moved around the board following the bad guys. And every time a bad guy moves out of the space, it just takes damage. It's like being pecked to death by a duck. I've got a pet for one of my other ones that basically twice per scenario can just it's a little baby scorpion. You got a pet scorpion and it can get stabby and it poisons. It's also illegal. The pet's illegal. If I get caught with it, it's going to get taken away. It's so good. So much fun. And then, of course, in between cities, when you know, because you unlock the ability to get to these quests, and again, it gives you a card, and the card will be scenario 17. And then to enact scenario 17, you've got to follow the instructions on the card. And that might take you through a whole passage of the book and a little mini adventure. It might ask you to do... much like in Gloomhaven, you've got city events and you've got road events. You've got similar, but they're much more detailed. So, you know, a city event might take you 10 minutes to resolve and you're rolling dice and you're doing challenges. And man, Agamonia, honestly, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. And I can't stop wanting to play it. And it's why I only played two other games in the last week, because I've played 8 or 9 scenarios of Agamonia. And I cannot wait to get on the table and play some more. The whole campaign, I think, is 33 or 34 scenarios. So it's also not a huge one. And I also don't want to rush too much, because it's the kind of thing that I think once it's done, I'm not sure there's other characters to replay. But the joy I'm finding in Agamonia is in the constant reveal. You know, Tainted Grail, by comparison, I played two-handed with Tainted Grail, and the narrative that unfolds is so targeted at those two characters that, yes, the surprises of the narrative of the game itself may have been spoiled somewhat. The scenarios in Tainted Grail are such that there's 2 or 3 ways through each scenario, and so in your choices, there are 2 or 3 other choices sometimes that you haven't made that you can still experience. So I will 100% play Tainted Grail again. I have the sort of sneaking, nagging feeling that once I play Agamonia, it's back in the box, pass it on to somebody else, or sell it, because I don't see it as the kind of game to play twice. But let me tell you, for that first playthrough, it's outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. I cannot recommend it enough. If you like campaigns, and it plays solo, a dream. I played Isis Vanguard multi-handed. I played a couple of scenarios four-handed. It's a little bit of a stretch to play ISS four-handed. Not out of the question. But playing four-handed Agamonia, it is... The decision space is tactical, not strategic. The strategy comes into how you build. Going into a scenario, how you lay your build down, what armor you're taking, what tools you're taking, what bits you're buying to go in. And then from there, it's tactical. And it's so, so good. It is delicious. Is that, as I said, that first 2 or 3 scenarios of pastel green and safety orange and hot pink. And by the time you get to scenario 3, it's just part of the world you're immersing yourself in. So big props to the team. Can't recommend it enough. And now the clap. This week the clap goes to a noble, noble beast who has served me well for my 50 years on this planet. And it might seem silly, but for me, I can't do Christmas without it. And we've just had a week of Christmas. And, you know, Christmas is often a week of excess. It's too much food. It's too much cheese. It's too much wine. It's far too many people some days. And This week's clap goes out to the noble turkey. I'm Canadian. You lovely little beast who just sits there all year waiting and waiting and waiting. Oh, the noble turkey. My God, Christmas isn't Christmas without a turkey. And in Australia, it's very hard to find a turkey. And it's very hard to find a turkey that's of any size. Oh, thank you. Thank you for your sacrifice. I'm sorry. And that concludes this week's Gluttony for the Senses. With a month's worth of food disappearing in about 5 days, I'm actually personally happy to be getting back to normality. Tomorrow is New Year's Eve in Australia. We will be having cheese and charcuterie and fresh-baked focaccia and some delightful reds and whites and bubbles. And to all of you out there, I'm probably not going to get this out to you before New Year's Eve, but I hope 2024 was not horrible to you, and I hope 2025 is less horrible to you. It's been a tough few years post-COVID, and the economy's a stinker, and. All my thanks, all my love goes out to you guys. And good luck. You can reach me on all the socials. You can find me on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. You can email me at wonmanclapping@gmail.com. And I'm on Instagram at one man clapping. You can join the One Man Clapping Guild on BGG. Subscribe to Guild 4426 just so you can say that you have. And thank you as always for your time. This week's episode has been brought to you by an impending sense of dread as I side-eye the bathroom scale every morning. Until next time, get your game on, even if you go to play with yourself. And remember, board games are technically therapy, so you should be able to claim them on your medical insurance. I said should. Peace out, mofos. Locked in the bunker, shadows shake. One man clapping secrets awake. Board games live in dice, they break. Echoes pound and hearts, they quake. Dear Mr. Hammes, your claim for reimbursement for Civolution has been declined. It is not an approved form of therapy.